Let's begin. We read through chapters 7 and 8 last week, essentially the story of the battles of Ai. Battles in the plural, because essentially there are two. Right, there's the first campaign against Ai, which is a failure, and then they have to go back and do it all over again, albeit with a completely different strategy, different context, different mindset, but nonetheless, there clearly are two stages to the Battle of Ai. We started to look at the first campaign, number one, from just at the very end of the year. We asked the question, exactly what happened that was the tragedy. Yeshua's reaction to the battle is intense. His reaction, his theological reaction, is significant. He turns to God and he's angry and he's upset and he's complaining. So we asked the question, what exactly it was about the Battle of Ai that was so devastating? If there were 36 people killed, that's a tragedy, but it's not necessarily, it doesn't reflect the kind of reaction that Yeshua seems to give it. And we had made the suggestion that when the text tells us, when the Navi tells us at the end, that there were kish loshim v'shisha nashim, that when approximately 36 people were killed, the phrase approximately 36 is a very strange number. It's like, always intrigued by the statistics about the birth rate of families. 2.2 children per family. What does 2.2 children mean? How do you have a 0.2 in the statistic? Right, how do you have approximately 36 people? Kishloshim v'shishayish. And the suggestion that we had made was that we see from, I showed you a verse in Shmuel Bet, we see from other contexts that there were often times when there were units of soldiers, and the units were comprised of 12. That seems to have been a standard number for a fighting unit. But certainly within the context of Bnei Israel, it would make sense, because you would have a number that represented the 12 Shvatim. And you see it by Shmuel, where you had Shaul and the armies of David and Ishbosheth, son of Shaul, where they each sent out 12 soldiers to fight. That seems to have been like a yechidah or a unit. And if that's the case, then kish loshim v'shisha ish may mean that they sent out three of these front units, three of these marine-type commando units, and they were destroyed. And the moment they were destroyed, the rest of the battle continues with the rest of the army. And at the end, when it says, V'yaku mehem anshe ha'ai kishloshim v'yishisha ish v'yirdufum lifne hashar ad ha'shvarim v'yakum b'morat. That initially they smote the 36 who attacked, and then they chased them, and v'yakum b'morat, as they were going down the hill, they smote them. So that second phrase seems to indicate a second stage of tragedy. And there, I would say, v'yimas levav ha'am, the people were distraught, I suspect, because in fact what really happened was the entire fighting force of 3,000 that they had sent was decimated. Whether they were all destroyed or whether there was a few survivors, but certainly I think the implication is that the entire army was decimated. And so this really was not just a defeat, and not just a defeat of 36 people, but a devastating defeat of the entire army, the entire group that they had sent to fight against Ai, especially given the fact that they initially said that this is easy. Alti agasham et kol ha'am, don't weary everybody else out by another battle, just send a delegation or one platoon and take them out. And that platoon got destroyed. They were caught in a very difficult position. That's essentially where we left off at the end of the shiur last week, correct? I think that's what the last thing that we had done. I think the most significant question in this perek is clearly the theological one, namely,
why were so many people destroyed because one person
One person sinned, and the Achan sins, and everybody's and the whole army is destroyed, and the people are decimated, and the battle of Israel takes of Canaan. Starts on a left foot. The implications of the failure of Ai are felt for generations to come. The conquest of Canaan didn't happen the way it was supposed to happen. That meant that the Canaanites stuck around for more generations than they were supposed to. That meant that there was more idolatry in the land. That meant that we were susceptible to the cultural cultural influence of the idolatry. That meant that. I mean, you could draw a link from the Battle of Ai to the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash if you wanted to. 1,000 years later, the failure of the Battle of Ai has ramifications. It's like the tipping point. It has ramifications for everything that happens subsequently. And you have to ask yourself the question, all of this because one person put his hand in the till. Is that fair? Is that right? Is that correct? Is that accurate? Is it really the chait of one person? And if so, what is it about his chait that was so significant? What I'd like to do over the next couple of shiurim, it'll be today, and we'll probably carry it over one, possibly two more shiurim, is I'd like to draw what I think are concentric circles of accountability. In other words, my impression is that there's multiple layers of problem. Achan is one problem, and we will have to address exactly what the problem was with the Cherem and why taking of the Cherem was so terrible, and beyond just his guilt, what else did it accomplish and did it achieve in terms of the conquest of Canaan. But I think that there are multiple concentric circles. You have Achan's guilt. I don't think you can really discuss Achan's guilt without some level of guilt and accountability for B'nai Yisrael as well. Certainly the tribe, the family, the immediate circle around Achan. And then there's even the broader context of B'nai Yisrael as a whole. And ultimately the broadest context, which is Yahushua himself.
What do you mean by whether or not it's truthful? What does that mean?
Whether what's truthful?
You said in that whole list of things, whether or not this
whether it's just his one sin.
Right, in other words, are we dealing with just one chait, or are we dealing with a multiple layers of
guilt? So we're not
guilt.
Talking about whether it's true or not true.
No. Right. In other words, if I'm looking at this from a schematic point of view, I think there's a level of accountability for Achan, and certainly the text points to Achan, the story points to Achan, the message that God gives to Yahushua is deal with Achan and then we can talk. You can't deal with Achan, however, without dealing at some point with the let's call it the family, for lack of a better term, but it's really the whole environment surrounding Achan, which we'll see in the Gemara. The Gemara says you can't hold Achan accountable without also holding accountable on some level the family and the tribe. And that's why the lot takes place in such a complex way. Then beyond that, you have I think you have a level of accountability for B'nai Yisrael as a whole. And we'll see exactly at what point and where that accountability lies. But the strongest hint to it is the opening statement when God says to Yahushua, what are you crying to me for? Chatai Yisrael. V'gam avruat briti. V'gam lakhu min acherim. V'gam ganvu. V'gam kichashu. V'gam samu b'chil yehem. You have this refrain of Israel sin. And they took of the cherem, and they stole, and they lied about it, and they put it, and they buried it in their tents. So before we get to Achan, we have this declaration of Chatai Yisrael. Is Israel being held accountable just for Achan's sins, or are these different things? There's Chatai Yisrael. V'gam lakum min acher. Israel sinned and they took of the cher. Is that one thing or is that two? Is there a chet here beyond the cher that we have to identify? And the third concentric, the fourth concentric circle, which I think is probably the one that's, I wouldn't say most significant, but cannot be ignored, is Yehoshua. Is he accountable in some way? I put Yehoshua at the end. That's the largest concentric circle. Why? If these are increasing by numbers, why did I put Yehoshua in the outside largest circle? Because there's a leadership issue. And if he sins, if he's misleading, if his role here isn't 100% kosher, then that's going to spill over down the road. So these are the levels that I think we need to look at the story, and given the fact that the impact here is so significant for generations to come, I don't think it is fair to look at it just on the superficial level of Achan, Achan's chet, Achan's sin, and now life goes on. What indications do I have that there's more than one level of accountability here? Besides this enigmatic phrase, Chatai Yisrael v'gam lakum min acher. What indications are there in the story that there's multiple layers of accountability, of fault here? Well, number one, there's such a big punishment. Just for Achan's sin alone, maybe there's an element of communal responsibility, there's an element of Yiko Yisrael, Arevim Zebazeh. That's true, but nonetheless, it begs the question.
Because the battles were in layers, the first supposedly 36, and then the second attack where many more were involved.
Well, that's one attack. It's one, that's one campaign. Which one are you talking about?
Approximately 36 were killed.
And then the 3,000 were killed. But that's part of one campaign. But yeah, I think you're on the right track. There were multiple campaigns. Right, there were two. The Battle of Ai is two battles of Ai. The first battle and the second battle. The first battle, he sends 3,000 people. They get, the 36 get decimated, the 3,000 get decimated. The second battle is Perek Chet, and there Yeshua sends, right, there he sends, if you take a look at the beginning of Perek Chet, right, he sends multiple groups, 5,000 people in one group, 30,000 in another group, the rest of the people in a third group, right, Pasuk Yudbet, Leikach kechameshet alafim ish, takes 5,000 people and he puts them, and they're sitting in one place at an ambush. Then he takes with him Kol Ha'am into a second position to lie in wait to be in ambush. I'm just looking for the phrase. At one point it says he takes something like 30,000 people with him into the campaign the second time around. Right? So if he's taking 30,000 people the second time around, you have to ask yourself the simple question, if the problem was just Achan, and Achan is killed at the end of chapter 7, and if 3,000 people attacked the city of Ai, and Achan was at fault, and Achan is now taken care of, then what should happen next?
Everything should be fine.
Right? They should go back to the city. How? They got to go and conquer Ai, right? Excuse me?
They should have gone victoriously.
They did go victoriously. I think you're missing my point. Plan one. Let's call it Plan A. How many soldiers? 3,000. Problem. Fate. Achad. Right? Therefore, result is defeat. Okay? Subsequently, deal with Achan. Okay, so what happens to Achan? We take him out of the picture. Plan B. What comes next? Right. What should come next?
Yeah.
No. What should come next? You sent 3,000 soldiers and they were defeated. Why were they defeated? Ostensibly because
Achan.
Good. So you've taken care of Achan. Now, what should you do?
Go back with another group.
Send people.
How many?
3,000.
Why 3,000?
Because
that was the original plan, and the only reason it failed was because of Achan, which means that once you take care of Achan, if you really want to demonstrate that the problem was Achan, if you really want to show that if it wasn't for Achan, you would have been victorious, then what you should do, logically, is go back with the exact same battle plan. And this time you'll be victorious, because the source of the problem was not the battle plan, the source of the problem was Achan. So logic dictates, and theology dictates, that if you want to demonstrate theologically, philosophically, that the problem was in fact Achan, as the text seems to convey, then Plan B should have been an exact replica of Plan A.
But are you assuming that everyone felt it was Achan's fault?
God says it's Achan's fault. I don't care what everybody else thinks. God says so, Yeshua says so, assuming I take the text verbatim. Assuming I take what's here as we understood it initially, which is that the problem lies with Achan, and hence we ask the question, why should one person sin and everybody suffers, right? That's the basis of that question assumes that the basis of the guilt is Achan's alone. The moment I take Achan out of the picture, logically I should then go back with 30,000. Instead, with 3,000. Instead, I go back with 30,000 plus 5,000 plus Kol Ha'am. So how many is that? Enough?
Over,
right? For a city of 12,000 soldiers. The whole city is 12,000 soldiers. It's one thing to go back with three, to go with 3,000 and say God is with us, we'll do it one to four, not a problem. You go back with 35, 50, 100,000 soldiers to take out 12,000 soldiers, a little bit of overkill. What's to stop people from saying, well, this Achan had nothing to do with it, it was just that we didn't have enough soldiers here, so we send in, call it the surge plan? So we send in a surge plan. Oh, the surge plan is working. We sent in 35,000 and now we beat them. So clearly the problem lay with the battle plan and not with Achan. So does not this plan defeat the very theological message that the text is trying to convey? That it's the chet of Achan that was the cause of the problem?
But many times in a battle, you switch gears.
Yeah, but not if you want to convey the message that the problem was not the military strategy, but the religious mandate. If your message is if you're trying to create the message that the problem is Achan's chet, why were we defeated? Says God, Chata Yisrael, because Achan sinned. Well, if that's the message you want to convey, then you deal with the problem, and then repeat the plan. Because if you don't repeat the plan exactly as it was originally, then you simply open up the opportunity for people to say Achan had nothing to do with it. The whole thing was we didn't have enough troops. So if you're trying to stay true to the message of the text, which is that the problem was Achan, I don't understand why we sent in 10 times more, if not more than 10 times, the number of soldiers. Would have been made much more sense to repeat the original battle plan. 3,000 soldiers, send them in, and you see this time they're victorious. Clearly the problem was just Acha. Unless what we're trying to the message that we're receiving is that we're dealing with a problem on multiple layers. And whereas Acha is one part of the problem, there are other parts of the problem that need to be addressed here as well. And so that's really, to my mind, that's really the first indication and the strongest indication that the story is more complex than we see at first read. And so we need to explore a little bit more in detail what happened, who was at fault, and why. And I think that there's so many lessons to be learned from this on so many different levels that it's worthwhile spending a little bit of time doing this. Yeah?
Can I put this back? Refresh my memory, please. Yehoshua, at the beginning, before the first battle, did he not say this is a simple...
The people, said that. The spies who he sent to Yericho said that. And Yeshua agrees. He follows their recommendation. We'll come back to that issue. That's part of what I think lies at the fault level here and here. When you deal with the fault of Bnei Yisrael and the fault of Yeshua, part of the issue is going to be that initial spy mission and what their message they came back with. And again, the text, I want to make this very clear, the text conveys one source of fault at first read, namely, who is at fault? Acha. And seems to put all the blame on Acha's shoulders. And I think from a theological level, that's certainly the most significant part of it. What I'm suggesting to you is that in addition to that very significant primary source of fault, there are elements of fault along the way that we need to address and understand. So let us begin with Acha. Today we're going to spend some time discussing Achan and where he is at. Again, I'm not ignoring these. We'll come back to them. Family, Bnei Yisrael, and Yehoshua. But for right now, I want to deal with specifically what was Achan's chet, and why was it so calamitous that it would have national repercussions?
Is this the only battle that is dissected, is dissected to this minutiae?
No, all of the battles of Yehoshua are dissected to this minutiae. It's the only battle that we lose. So it has theological implications. Subsequent to the Battle of Ai, Yehoshua never loses a battle. You learn your lessons the hard way once, you never make the same mistakes twice, you hope. But there, all the battle plans of Yehoshua are detailed. In fact, it's well known that David Ben-Gurion used to study Sefer Yehoshua in depth for the strategy of Sefer Yehoshua, because from a strategic point of view, it is an enormously powerful military text. And we'll see some of the campaigns. We're going to look at some of them because they are the brilliance of them from a purely strategic point of view, before, without even getting to the issue of the role of the Kodesh Baruch Hu and Siyata Dishmaya and everything else. From a purely strategic point of view, Plan B is a brilliant strategy. The ambush and the coming up from behind and draw the defeat. They were defeated the first time, so the army of Ai thought they had the upper hand, and they go out of the walls and they draw them into the open field, and then the ambush goes and they lay waste to this, and they raise the city, which creates disheartened sense of the soldiers of Ai. It was a brilliant strategic move, and has subsequently been repeated many times. Yehoshua is the first, so. As a strategist, as a military strategist, he's a genius. Now, is he being guided by a higher power? Sure. But nonetheless, I think you can't take away from him his strength and his capability. So the text goes through those battles in detail. We'll come to it.
I may be jumping the gun, but do we know when Acham took from the Cherem, did he do it privately, or were there people that witnessed what he did?
Well, we'll get to that. When we get to concentric circle number two, which is family, we'll get to that question of how much guilt by association or accomplice lies beyond just Acha. That's the Gemara that you have. That's the Gemara in Sanhedrin, which is on your source page, and Bezrat Hashem will come to it. So let's start with an attempt to understand Acha. Or at least to understand what it is about Achan's chet of taking from the cherub that the Navi felt was so severe, so harsh, so bad that it warranted any kind of response, especially the kind of response of military defeat for the army of Israel. And to understand that, we have to go back to the question of the purpose of the cherub altogether. To understand the severity of Achan's violation of the cherem, obviously that question is going to be linked to the question of why was there a cherem altogether. Remember that it seems that Yeshua imposes this cherem on his own, or maybe there was a divine decree to such an extent. Though it's not on the text, but clearly there is a significance to this cherem, so significant that God calls it His brit. Right in Pasuk Yud Aleph, Chatai Yisrael v'gamavru et briti, when He describes the sin of taking of the cherem, asher tiviti v'gam lakchu min hacherem, He calls it His brit. Right? He calls it His covenant, which Israel violated. So the violation of the cherem is a violation of a brit. And that itself raises the question, what is it about the cherem that was so significant that it became a brit? That goes back to our whole discussion in the previous couple of shiurim, so what the cherem was all about. And we had, if you remember, a number of different possible interpretations of what the cherem was, starting with the very fact that this entire battle of Yericho was set in place by a malach. Remember the engagement with the malach back in Parakeh, who comes to Yeshua and he says, "Shal na lecha mi'arag lecha, take your shoes off. This is holy ground. This is right. This is a place of divine revelation." This is a place where there is a malach, an angel, who is going to fight this battle. We compared, if you remember, the fall of the walls of Yericho to the experience of Mamre HaSinai, to that moment when there was kolot uvrakim, thunder and lightning, to the thunder and the sounds of the fall of the walls. We compared the blowing of the shofar to the blowing of the shofar at HaSinai, and Yericho falls. The whole experience of Yericho was to mimic the experience of Mamre HaSinai. And the depth of the revelation, that the open revelation of God's manifestation at that moment. And that's why it started with a malach, it starts with an angel, it has that whole divine character to it. Now, there is something about Gilui Shechina, there is something about a moment of revelation that we have to understand. And that is that a moment of revelation of on any level, certainly at the level of Mamre HaSinai, but even with just a malach, even if it's just an angel representing the Ribbono Shel Olam, a moment of revelation is a mixed blessing. Why? Any moment of revelation is a mixed blessing. What's the mixed blessing about it? Revelation is good. Revelation is God's presence. Revelation is you see God, you feel God, you have the experience of the presence. Why is it a mixed blessing?
Yeah, because it's supernatural. It takes things out of the normal realm.
In a broader sense, that's probably true, but I'm looking for something much more acute, much more immediate, much more dangerous. It's not only theologically, philosophically problematic, it's dangerous. It's a mixed blessing because it's dangerous.
Yeah,
when there are problems lurking somewhere. There's health issues.
You're saying two different things. Let's do this in one at a time, because if I do this in stereo, I'm going to get confused. Okay? Adina, let's start with your suggestion.
You're getting a revelation, but the revelation is because maybe outside there's some issues and problems that need to be taken care of. You're the focal point of it.
That's possible. The question is what's dangerous there, but I'll accept that as a possibility. Debbie, what were you going to...
Now it's your turn.
Invincible, that, you know, you've got help.
You feel invincible, okay.
Yeah,
opposite.
It comes with responsibilities.
Right.
Comes with responsibilities.
Well, if you don't do what God says, then, I mean, it's right there. God is right there telling you very clearly.
Oh.
So if you go against
if you're in the if you are in the midst of a revelation, if you're in the midst of God's presence, you're in the midst of a Gilui Shechina, and you outstep or overstep or misstep a quarter of a centimeter or a quarter of a millimeter, there's no room for error. You are standing in the palace. You are standing in the presence of the Rabbanu Shalom.
You can't say, oh, I misunderstood.
Yeah, there's not a lot of room for error. Anytime you have a Gilui Shechina, anytime you have a revelation of God's presence, at any point, it comes as a double message. It comes on the one hand as a demonstration of God's greatness and his love for Israel and his rachamim and his chesed and his compassion and his connection. And there is, without question, rachamim and chesed and closeness. And at the same time, there is din. And there is strong din. And you can't have one without the other. What Maamar HaSinai set in place was, how many times does Moshe tell the people they have to stay away from the mountain? How many times does Moshe say, pin, not to touch the mountain, because if you touch the mountain, you will die? Whoops! Sorry, made a mistake, didn't mean it. Sakol yisakel yerei yerei, touch the mountain, you die. There's no options. There's no whoops, I'm sorry. Alright? We'll come back to Achan in a second, but that's exactly right. But you know, it's the closest analogy I can give you is if you run a stop sign, and there's a head on and you get collided by a car on the side, and you go, whoops, I'm sorry. All it takes is a split second, and the damage is done. When you're standing in the presence of God, there's an ultimate expression of midat hadin, of judgment, that's unforgiving, despite as much as we want to say that God should be forgiving and compassionate, etc. In the midst of Gilui Shechina, there's no room for that. That's part of the reason why God is removed from the world on an ongoing basis, because if he's not, there would be no way to survive. Human nature would be such that we wouldn't be able to survive. I'll show you a couple of examples. Psukim that we actually once read, but open up again to Shmot Perek Chav Gimel. We read them dafka in the context of the story of Yeshua's angel. Take a look at Shmot Perek Chav Gimel. Pasuk Chaf. Chaf. The end of Parshat Mishpatim. Hine anochi sholeach malach lefanecha. God is describing the angel that will accompany Israel on their journey into the conquest of Canaan. I will send a malach before you, lishmorcha baderech, to protect you, to guard you, to lead you into the land of Canaan, ulahaviacha lamakom asher achinoti, and to prepare the land, prepare for you, or to give you the land that I have prepared. And then, so, in other words, right there I have what seems to be the story of the malach of Yehoshua. The malach who comes to Yehoshua and says, Atabati, I have come now to help you, to assist you in fighting this battle against Canaan. And in the same breath, the Torah says, Hishamem mipanav, ushma b'kolo. Guard yourself, watch yourself, careful. Listen to everything he says. Al tamerbo. Do not trespass. Do not rebel against him. Ki lo yisa lefi shechem, he will not be forgiving of your iniquity. Ki shmi bikirbo, because my name is amongst, is amidst him. Ki im shamoa tishma bekolo vesita kol asher daber, v'ayavti et oivecha v'tzarti et tzarelecha. If you will do exactly as he says, and you will do exactly what he instructs, then I will be the enemy of your enemies, and I will destroy your enemies. Ki helech malachim lefanecha v'yivecha el ha'emori v'achiti v'apisi v'aknini v'achiviv, then I will send my malach before you, and I will destroy all the nations of Canaan. Don't bow down to them, don't serve them, etc. In other words, the very same psukim that tell me that Yeshua is going to be met by a malach who's going to lead them into the battle, which is exactly the story of Yericho, says to me, be careful. This is not an ordinary circumstance. Ordinary circumstance, you can forgive a chet, you can work through a misstep at some point or another. When the malach is in your midst, when there's a gilui shechina right there, like at Mamre HaSinai, there's no room for a misstep. The slightest variation or deviation is going to be is significant. I'll give you another example on a much more mundane level. If you're aiming a gun or a cannon, and you're shooting 5 feet in front of you, your margin of error for your aim is significant. But if you're aiming that gun 1,000 feet in front of you, or 100,000 feet in front of you, then your margin of error becomes much narrower. Right? Because even the slightest deviation, long term, over the long distance, has a much greater effect. When you're standing in the presence of the Ribbono Shel Olam, the slightest deviation, you're standing in the palace. So the slightest deviation has a much greater impact both on you and on the people and on everything else, and therefore the retribution is stronger. The classic example of this, the classic example of the fact that because of the Gilui Shechina and the tiniest misstep, there's no room for a margin of error.
Moshe hitting
the rock, because Moshe stands in the presence of God on a regular, on a permanent basis. That may be, but I'm even more. You talk about a case of Gilui Shechina, where there is actual revelation of God's presence, and because of a tiniest misstep, tragedy occurs. You won't know the answer if I tell you. You'll see it right away. In almost every instance in Tanakh, by the way, almost every instance in Tanakh, revelation of some manifestation always appears in the form of, what form does Gilui Shechina usually take on? Almost always. No, actually.
Something that happens that's outside of nature.
Eish, always. From Moshe and the burning bush, to Marmon HaSinai, Umar'ek Kvod Hashem Ke'esh Ochelet Barosh Ahar, fiery consuming fire in the top of the mountain, to the dedication of the tabernacle, when Esh came out from the Holy of Holies to consume the offering on the Mizbeach, to Shlomo HaMelech's dedication of the temple, when the fire came out from heaven, to Eliyahu and Har HaKarmel, when the fire came out to consume the offering on the altar. Every manifestation of Gilui Shechina virtually has always taken the form of Esh. Only exception to that may be Yericho, because I haven't found Eish in the story of Yericho. But we have other things there. Does that help jog the memory?
Oh.
Of a manifestation of Gilui Shechina where somebody misstepped and paid the price for it? Tiniest little misstep.
The sense of motion.
Close. That's why I said close.
Okay.
That's why I said close.
Sorry.
Right? Nadav and Avihu is a classic example, because the whole story of Nadav and Avihu I don't know if you've ever noticed this, but the story of Nadav and Avihu is the story of the tragedy being in the wrong place at the wrong time. If you take a look, for example, if you take a look briefly at the beginning of Parashat Shemini, somebody really wants me badly. Take a look at the beginning of Parashat Shemini, Vayikra Perek Tet. I'll show you a couple of psukim. I'll show you. First, first pasuk vav. Everybody see it? Vayomer Moshe, ze adavar asher tziva Hashem tasu ve'yira aleichem kvod Hashem. This is what you must do, and the kvod Hashem, the glory of God, will appear to you. From remember, Marmar Hasina, you mar'e kvod Hashem ke'esh ochelet barosh ahar. Kvod Hashem is manifest as a consuming fire on the top of the mountain. This you shall do, and you will see the Kvod Hashem, which is this consuming fire. Everybody with me? Series of Korbanot, exactly as Moshe delineates, and you will all experience Kvod Hashem, meaning some kind of visual manifestation. This is, in a sense, like a repeat of Mamre Sinai, except now it's in the Mishkan. What was the first and most important rule in the Mishkan, in Mamre Sinai for the people?
Don't touch.
Stay away. Hagbel et ha'har v'kidashto. Separate yourself from the mountain. Can't get close because there's fire. You're going to get destroyed. Now take a look at Pasuk Chav Gimel. Vayavo Moshe v'Aaron alo ha'moed. Vayetzu v'yivarchu et ha'am. Moshe and Aaron go into the tent. They come out. They bless the people. Vayera kvod Hashem el kol ha'am. And the kvod Hashem appeared to the people. How? Next pasuk. Vateitze esh milifnei Hashem, vatochal ala mizbeach. This manifestation of the kavod was through a fire that emerged from milifnei Hashem, which is always a reference to the Holy of Holies. So the fire emerged from the Holy of Holies, vatochal ala mizbeach, and consumed the offering on the altar. So if everybody with me? Pasuk Perek Yud Pasuk Aleph. Vayikhu b'nei Aaron Nadav v'Avihu Ish Machtato. Nadav and Avihu took their frying pans. Vayiknu b'hem Eish v'yesimu aleha Ktoret. They put into their frying pan some kind of incense, some kind of offering. Vayakrivu lifnei Hashem Eish Zara. They brought lifnei Hashem again means before the Holy of Holies, either inside the Holy of Holies or between the Holy of Holies and the Mizbeach. But lifnei Hashem in the temple context means something related to the Holy of Holies. Asher lo tziva otam, to which they were not commanded. Vateitze esh milifnei Hashem vatochal otam. The fire came out from the Holy of Holies and consumed them. Take a look at these two psukim side by side. Perek Tet, Pasuk Chaf Dalid, and Perek Yud, Pasuk Bet. Vateitze Eish, Lifnei Hashem. Finish the Pasuk in Perek Tet. Vatochal Al Hamizbeach. Perek Yud, Vateitze Eish, Lifnei Hashem. Vatochal Gotam. They are virtually identical pasuk. Says the Rashbam, what happened here? How many times did the fire appear? So when we read it sequentially, we see this as two different events. Says the Rashbam, it's not true. It's one event. Here's the Kodesh HaKadosh. Here's your Mishkan. Here's your Kodesh HaKadoshim. And here is your Mizbeach. Vateitze esh milifne Hashem vatochel al mizbeach. Where were Nadav and Avihu? They were bringing a ktoret lifne Hashem. Between the Mizbeach and the Mishkan, or even worse, inside the Mishkan. What happened?
They got caught in the
crossfire, literally. That's exactly what the Rashbam says, although I don't think he used the word crossfire, but that's exactly what he says. They were in the wrong place at the wrong time. So tell me, how could that happen? God should be compassionate and rachamim, and they weren't deserving it, and it was a terrible tragedy. All of that's true. But when you're standing in the presence of the Shekhinah, there's no room for error. There's an absolute expression of din that's unforgiving. The fire, that fire is on a one-way street. You can't, you're not going to bypass another one of you.
Well,
they're culpable for having taken the initiative to go where they shouldn't have gone. They're in the wrong place, the wrong time, by their own initiative.
It's not like they were targeted specifically.
Right. That's what the Rashbam says. It wasn't that they were targeted.
It's different opinions, obviously.
Right. But the textual context is very compelling. The textual context is very compelling. There are midrashim and the ramaphoshim that are uncomfortable with the notion of that they weren't punished for a specific sin. According to the Rashbam, it wasn't so much that they were punished, but that their mistake put them into a position where they were going to be consumed.
Because of where
they were at. Because of the notion that Gilui Shekhinah is an absolute din. There's no room for... Right, that's when the Torah says that the Malach is going to come and lead you into the land of Israel, Hishamer mipanav. That's a mixed blessing. You want to fight this battle together with Gilui Shekhinah, that's great. Manifestation of God and the works and the impact for Israel and for Canaanites and everything. That's great. But it comes with a price tag. And the price tag is, you misstep here. And there's serious consequences. When you talk about the cherem, and the cherem is a symbol of the divine nature of this battle. The cherem was a message. This battle was fought by God. The cherem was a message. This battle was fought by, not by Israel, but by Gilui Shekhinah, by the Malach. And then Achan goes and takes of the cherem. What is he saying? I don't hold by the Malach, I hold from the Gilui Shekhinah, and the whole thing is, you can tell me I can't take my gold, who are you to tell me what I can and cannot do? Well, I have news for you, Acha. Making your own rules for what you can and cannot do is essentially the definition of idolatry. And if the battle against Yericho was essentially a battle between God and the gods of Yericho, a battle between the Ribbono Shel Olam and the false gods of Baal, there's no room for error there. That's Eliyahu and Har Carmel. That's fire coming down from heaven. You can't simply say at that moment, well, you know what, I was tempted by a piece of gold. Your temptation of a piece of gold was to undermine the very message of what this battle was all about. It was all about that this is God's battle, and that we reject the idolatry of Baal, and we reject everything that idolatry represents, and we reject all the idolatry of Canaan, and symbolized by Yericho. And therefore God will come into this battle, and this is a epic confrontation between the God of Israel and the pantheon of gods of Canaan. It all boils down to that first battle of Yericho. And for Achan to cavalierly ignore all of that and take of the cherem, and then to hide it and to bury it and not let anybody know about it and to cover up, and all of that essentially means that the attitude vis-a-vis the divine message of the Malach and the battle of Yericho and the battle against Baal and everything that means is essentially dismissed. If it's dismissed by Achan, then that has implications beyond. So I think that helps us, at least it helps me understand a little bit more the depth of what Achan's mistake was. It wasn't just greed. It was greed in the face of a revelation, greed in the face of the Malach, greed in the face of Mamre Har Sinai, Hakamat Mishkan and Yericho, a sequence of three events all paralleling each other, and into that Achan threw his mix. It's another Nevi'il 10 times worse. Well, that's the second concentric circle of the issue. That's correct. That's the question of whether or not the Chay belongs just to him, or is there a group around him of like-minded people? You know, is he sinning in a vacuum, or is there a context? That's exactly the question that we will ask next, which is the second circle. I just want to talk a little bit about Achan first before we do that.
Is the fact that it's greed an important concept in all of this or not? I mean, what if it was something...
I think it's important. I think it's significant. I think you can hold him accountable more because it's personal greed rather than I don't know what else it could be. But if it was insubordination against Yehoshua and therefore an act of treason, it would be worse, not better. If it was, if he had. Somebody dying of hunger and he needed and he stole a loaf of bread to feed them, maybe there'd be room to
it just sounds that you're making the greed a big, or maybe not, but it's
well, I think it certainly
the
text certainly describes it as such, right? He took what did he take? He said, I saw gold and I saw silver and I took it and I coveted it and I wanted it and I buried it. Right. There's certainly an element of greed here that puts him in the middle of it, but again, if it was just the chait of greed, I don't think you could hold him that accountable to the extent that it spills over into a national calamity. But when you look at it as greed in the face of and at the moment of, it would be like, I don't know, what would be the closest analogy?
I don't know if you were talking about treason and making this whole circles and everything as much to me more of an impact than
well, it's greed at a moment when that greed becomes not so much treasonous but rebellious. Yeah, it's not treason against Yeshua yet, although we'll get there. It's not treason against Yeshua, but it's certainly monumental. If you're going to be greedy, you have to know when to be greedy. It's a little bit of a little bit of common sense, you know. The,
so 50 billion is maybe the end result.
Yeah, I mean, even the 50 billion. I mean, I guess maybe. It's one thing to steal from the poor. It's another thing to steal from the treasury of the king. And it's a third thing to steal from the treasury of the King of Kings. And it's a fourth thing to steal from the treasury of the King of Kings when the King of Kings is watching. And it's altogether another thing to steal from the treasury of the King of Kings when not only is he watching, but he's opened his treasury to the entire world and said, this is mine, don't touch. You see what's going on?
Well, yeah, when you explain it that way.
You know, it's greed, but it's also a question of when and where and how and under what circumstances there's a time and place. Now, I'll take this idea one step further, and I think it's if we put it into a little bit of a historical context, the next time you go visiting Petach Tikva, you'll remember this story. for the benefits of those who are going to visit Israel soon. The story also has a historical national perspective, just to give you a sense of how, for how many generations, the impact of the story of Ai were not only functioned in the consciousness of Israel as a symbol of the worst possible moment to be greedy, if you will. Remember that, and I think that it's more than just greed. I think if you look at Yericho as a symbol of Baal, and the Battle of Yericho as the first and most open confrontation between God and the gods of Baal, which are the indigenous deities of Canaan, like this battle really is at the core. It's the Kriyat Yamsuf, it's the Makat Bechorot of Yetziat Mitzrayim. It's the plague against the Nile in Egypt. Here it's against Jericho in Canaan. And to undermine that, really, is to reset Baal on its feet. It's to side with Baal, if you almost. Which has a much more, you know, it goes beyond greed, it goes into idolatry, even if it's not intentional. And I think we saw the comparisons between Yericho and Ir HaNidachat. If you remember back to the Cher. It had an Ir HaNidachat characteristic because of this battle against Baal. If you take a look at the psukim, go back to Perek Zion for a moment. Yeshua Perek Zion. Go to the end with a dialogue with Achan. When Achan is finally brought to justice, if you will, Pasuk Chav Dalet. Vaykach Yeshua et Achan ben Zerach. Yeshua takes Achan. Ve'et akesef et haderet ve'et lashon hazahav. He takes all the gold and silver and the cloaks. He takes everything that Achan stole. It's very public that the address to Achan also has to address the greed that Achan took, the trespass itself. Vet benav, vet bonotav, vet shorov, vet chamorov, vet zonov, vet olov, vet kol asher lo is family, and we'll get to the issue of the family guilt by association next year, and everything that he had. V'chol Yisrael imo, and he took, and all of Israel, and they all went up, v'yalu oto emek achor, and they went up to this valley called Emek Achor. Why Achor? Where does the word Achor come from? Right? The word Achor itself means muddied or troubled. Ma'im Akurim is muddied waters. Ocher Yisrael is the trouble of Israel, the trouble, the one who causes the trouble for Israel, the guilty one who is. I don't even know if there's an English translation that works. What does it say here? No, we'll get to the verb in a moment. We'll get to the verb in a moment. We'll see. I'll show it to you. Vayomer Yehoshua. Yeshua says to him, Ma achartanu, how much you have troubled us. But it's much worse. I mean, it's like call somebody Achor or Ocher Yisrael. It's like the source of all our problems. And you were the guilt. You were the source of all our problems. If it wasn't for you, everything would be good. You are the guilty one. Eliyahu and Achav have a showdown in Har Carmel. That showdown begins when Achav says to Eliyahu, who had decreed a drought for 3 years. I don't know if we haven't just studied that, but Eliyahu had decreed a drought for 3 years in order to punish Achav and the people for the idolatry of Achav. So the first time they meet after the three-year drought, people are dying on the streets because of this drought. Achav says of Eliyahu, Ocher Yisrael ata, you are the trouble of Israel, meaning you are the cause of all of the death and suffering that we are. And Eliyahu's response is, I got news for you. It's not me. It's you. Because this is all a response to your idolatry. You understand that we're talking about on a national scale. Ocher means it has a very powerful message. Vayomer Yehoshua, Ma achartanu? You are the cause. You are the guilt. You are the cause of all our troubles. Therefore, Ya'akorcha Hashem b'yom hazeh. God will trouble you on this day. Pay you back. Mida k'neged mida. He's killed there, killed. It's not clear who dies, but nonetheless, somebody dies here, certainly Achan. And they bury him. First, they hang him on a tree. Then they take him down. Vayashav Hashem Micharon Apo, in the next pasuk, God's anger is appeased. Now listen to the phrase. Al Kain Kara Shem HaMakom Hahu Emek Achor. That place is called Emek Achor. Emek Achor means the valley of
trouble.
So Emek Achor is essentially the name given to the valley in the aftermath of the Battle of Jericho, which is a battle against the idolatry of Baal, in which Yehoshua had in which Achan had violated the Chayim. That's where the phrase Emek Achor comes from. Everybody with me? So why is this relevant to Petach Tikva?
I'm waiting.
Okay. So now turn to a Navi, to Navi Hosea. This is now years later. We are years later. The days of Uziyahu. The days of Yerovam ben Yoash. Jumping way ahead of ourselves. 700-800 years into the future. Sefer Hosea. Well, Yeshayahu, Yirmiyahu, Yechezkel. That's the three big ones, followed immediately by Treyasar. Hosea is the beginning of Treyasar. Perek Bet.
This one is 676. How many years are we turning here?
Has been 5,800. Right. Mm-hmm. Context. Yehoshea is fighting against the idolatries of Baal. Ufakadati aleat yemeha be'alim. I will hold Israel accountable for the sins of the days of the worship of Baal. Hashet taktir lehem. Pasuk tetvav. Sorry, did I not say that? My apologies. Pasuk tetvav. Fakadti aleat yemei abealim hashet taktir lehem. I will hold them accountable for the days of the worship of Baal. Vatad nizma vechayeta vatelech. They went after all of their loved ones. Right? Baal has a very remember Baal and Ashtoreth are consorts. There's a male female. There's a sexuality to the idolatry of Baal. And in their love and lust for Baal, they have forgotten me, their real master, their real Baal, if you will. Hine anochi mifateha v'holachtia hamidbar. I will entice her. I will draw Israel back to me. I will bring her into the desert, back to the days of Yitzhak Mitzrayim, when there was this love, this marriage with God. V'dibarti al liba. I will speak to her heart. I will reconnect with Israel. V'netati la et krameha misham. I will give her new vineyards. Plant new grapes, new growth. Ve'ek emek achor lefetach tikva, and I will transform the valley of trouble into the opening of hope. Ve'anta shama kimei ne'ureha, and there, as in the days of her youth, there will be this connection. Uchiyom alota me'eretz Mitzrayim, like the day they left Egypt. On that day, they will look to God and say, Ishi, in that reconnection of the marriage contract, and not Baal. The name of Baal will disappear from their mouths. They will no longer call their names, etc. The notion of the restoration of the relationship between God and Israel, the redemption, if you will, is connected to the uprooting of Baal and the reconnecting with God. And the famous phrase, Vahya Emek Achor Lefetach Tikva, which is in fact the reason why the city of Petach Tikva was named Petach Tikva. With one little proviso, it's in the wrong place. Right? Because Emek Achor is near Yericho, but when they founded Petach Tikva, Emek Achor was nowhere to be found, anywhere near. They couldn't get there. It wasn't part of the Yishuv. But one of the earliest cities that they set up in Israel, Petach Tikva was one of the earliest cities in was, in a sense, but I mean, I don't think that they looked at it from a theological perspective, but certainly the notion of Emek Achol, Petach Tikva, I stood it there at the center of the dream of the Zionists who founded the city. And I think in our context, in the story of Yericho, it's very compelling. This whole notion that Yericho, which represented the destruction of Baal and all of the troubles that it gave us over the years and the Achan calamity for generations to come, it's still Emek Achor. 750 years later, it's still Emek Achor, and they're still worshipping Baal. In Emek Achor, because of the Akur, because of the trouble that Achan caused. And the Navi looks to a time in the future when that will finally be uprooted and we will finally be able to transform Emek Achor back to Petach Tikva. That's the
What's
story.
So cool is that the names are taken from
Tanakh and all of them.
It's not like St. Louis that's named after some holy person.
Yeah, who burnt the Talmud in
exactly
in France.
That's what I'm saying.
Responsible for the destruction of the Talmud.
I mean, that's all right.
We are the answer, though, to that famous Louis, whatever it is, Louis the Ninth, who burnt the Talmud, because we're sitting here in St. Louis and Learning Tower.
Yeah, but someone should trace, I mean, I'm sure it's been done, all the names and their connections.
Oh, yeah.
Sure
every city that has a biblical name, people know what it is. I mean, you can go through it and do it. And, yeah.
Rabbi, you know what I find interesting this passage, because I'm interested in language, is in modern Hebrew, we refer to our husband, though, as Ba'ali, not Ishi.
Maybe you do.
When I bench, I don't say that.
I'm just saying, if you're having a conversation, which word do you use? If you're referring
So the truth is, biblical Hebrew distinguishes between Baal and Ish as from exactly this context. Baal has a hierarchical connotation, and Ish does not. Ish and Isha, there's no hierarchical implication in the words Ish and Isha. Baal and Isha have a hierarchical implication. Right? Baalut is ownership, master. And in the context of deities, right, that's the whole notion, is that the deity was called a Baal.
So in benching, should we change the word?
No, I don't think you necessarily need to bench to change the word in the benching, but I think you need to keep that in mind. All right, we'll stop here.